Please come to order. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judges Werke, Conley, Smith, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our WebEx court hearings. The rules of appellate procedure are the same by WebEx as they are in court. 15 minutes each to the attorneys to present your case in chief. An additional 5 minutes will be reserved to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose to exercise that option. I'm going to ask our marshal, Michael Gorwitz, to call the first case for consideration.
First case this afternoon is number A19-1557, State of Minnesota versus John Joseph Robinson.
Hello, counsel, if you'll please state your name and which party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your remarks, and you can proceed when you are ready.
Thank you, Judge. My name is William French. I represent John Joseph Robinson, who's the criminal defendant in this case. There are two issues that need to be discussed today. The first one I'm going to discuss is the evidentiary one. And the question is, can a governmental entity willfully and in bad faith delete evidence that might be useful to a person charged with a crime? The answer to that question is no, based on the case law that I've submitted in my brief. There's no dispute that the photographs taken by the inspector were deleted. There are no digital images left. The record isn't entirely clear exactly how that happened, but just to briefly summarize, photographs were taken on an iPhone. Of course, they're preserved digitally on an iPhone. They were transferred via email to a computer in the office of the inspector, and then they were printed out on paper, and then the digital file on the office computer was deleted.
All right, Mr. French, let me clarify what your argument is. I know during the evidentiary hearing, you argued that Mr. Robinson's Fourth Amendment rights were violated because of the manner in which the photographs were obtained. You didn't appeal that, correct?
No, that's
not for us.
That's correct.
We're not looking at that. We're looking at whether, in fact, there was inculpatory evidence on the digital version of the photos. Is that what you're arguing?
Yes.
And what did you indicate would have been relevant to your claim of inculpatory evidence on that file data?
Your Honor, we live in a digital age. Almost everything now is done digitally. When something, a record is preserved digitally, it contains significantly more information than just a photograph. A printed out photograph doesn't contain what's called the metadata. The metadata would be in the digital images. As I've said, almost everything is kept digitally these days, and I don't think it would be appropriate.
That's what I'm getting at. What is in those in the metadata? What is in the metadata that you're asking us to extrapolate from that would have been inculpatory as far as a defense that Mr. Robinson would have had?
Well, number one, there's a GPS component to photographs taken from an iPhone. And Mr. Robinson, as noted in the respondent's brief, is somewhat of a cell phone expert. He could have used that GPS information to determine exactly where the inspector was standing when she took these photographs. If she was standing on his property, they would, of course.
That goes back then again. This is where we link back into your Fourth Amendment violation, but you didn't appeal that.
Well, the Fourth Amendment violation, which was count two of the complaint, was dismissed by the court because of a Fourth Amendment violation. The other issue regarding the digital images was raised a kind of independently as a due process violation because there was information that could have been useful to the defendant, to the appellant here, that was destroyed. And I don't think
You're telling us, though, is the part that's destroyed is the potential GPS location of where the person was standing. That's what you're trying to establish, or am I hearing this wrong?
No, that's correct. And there's other information that would be in the digital information, including the date, time, and other information. It's much more comprehensive than a photograph. It's like taking a book.
Well, sure, I understand that, but how would that tend to provide your client with information that would tend to challenge his guilty?
Well, number one, he could establish that the photographs were taken on his property, therefore they wouldn't have been able to be used at the trial or the omnibus hearing. And as a result of that, he was unable to thoroughly challenge.
French, so I want to follow up on precisely that point. First of all, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I like to follow up on that point and Judge Werke's question. So it's my understanding that the district court dismissed or suppressed the photograph taken from your client's front steps, and that the alleged ordinance violation relating to that is gone. So now we're talking about the photographs from the public sidewalk. So are you suggesting that whatever this information was that was deleted would show that they weren't, that the photos weren't taken from the sidewalk, but were taken from your client's property? Is that it?
Yes.
Okay. So these photographs that are from the public sidewalk, I don't have them in front of me. Do they look like they're taken from the sidewalk, or do they look like there's, you know, grass and a fence? I'm trying to get a feel for why these photographs that appear to be taken from the sidewalk would suggest they really were taken from inside your client's property.
Well, there are some other photographs taken, Your Honor, that from the side of appellant's property. And there's even some evidence that the camera was put through the fence, which surrounds plaintiff property, surrounds the appellant's property. So it's not just photos from the public sidewalk, it's photos from all around the property that
that relate to the ordinance violation that's at issue right now?
Yes.
On appeal? Okay.
Yes.
Well, counsel, if I may, as I understand it, the photos were testified to have been taken either from the public sidewalk or from the neighbor's yard. Is that right?
Well, that's what the state claims. Yes. We can test that.
And you can test it based on what the photographs look like, or what your, as I understand your argument is, I think it's a due process violation that the photos were deleted, the metadata, including the metadata, because the metadata would have permitted you to make a suppression motion.
Well, that's right? Correct.
And they would have, because your argument is that the GPS, although I don't know if this is in the record, the GPS data would have been specific enough to be able to ascertain whether a photo was taken from just on the public sidewalk or inside the neighbor's yard or from inside his yard. Is that right?
Yes.
And is there evidence that you put in that would actually show that the missing metadata would have accomplished that?
Your Honor, I wasn't involved in either the omnibus hearing or the trial. I believe the transcript shows that the metadata could have been used to establish location. And so that was important to the defense. And I think the legal standard is evidence that may be useful. It doesn't, like, you don't have to, and how do we ever prove that metadata that doesn't exist would have been helpful?
It's like, I think one way would have been to provide how specific the metadata actually is. I mean, that's a knowable thing with respect to what is shown on what a phone photo would contain as metadata, right? Is how specific it would be. Because on the other side, of course, is the evidence from the person who took the photo saying, the inspector saying, this is where I took them.
Well, I agree with you.
Well, Mr. French, let me ask you this question. Does it make a difference if the person that took the pictures was not a police officer, was a manager of some sort? Does it matter whether this person that took the pictures was just making a mistake or that they were dishonest? I mean, does that bear into this? Have you made any such assertion that they did this with some ill motivation?
Well, Your Honor, I attached in my addendum a schedule for retention of documents by various offices around the state of Minnesota. In this case, not only was the digital information destroyed, it wasn't kept for as long as they should have kept it. If you look at addendum page 12, it sets out the timeline. And I think there should be a policy, and this is one policy that establishes uniformity throughout Minnesota. In other words, cities just can't decide for themselves, we're going to keep evidence we acquire for one day. That would be inappropriate. And there's definite guidelines here. And I know transparency in government is something that's often discussed, but when you really get down to it, are we really serious about it? We have to be serious about this data because it wasn't kept in accordance with the guidelines issued by the Department of Administration for all of Minnesota. That's where the bad faith comes in. Rochester can't get away with just destroying evidence that's not being held consistent with the state rules on this.
Council, may I ask with respect to bad faith, was there a factual finding by the district court as to whether this was in deletion was in bad faith or not?
Well, I don't think there was, Your Honor. I mean, it's looking at what they did here. They, in the age of transparency, they destroyed evidence inconsistent with the guidelines established by the state of Minnesota.
So, Mr. French, are you saying it doesn't matter? Doesn't matter if there was ill will or bad faith or anything like that? Doesn't matter that they just simply shouldn't have been destroyed?
Well, yeah, isn't that implicit in that is bad faith? I mean, if the government destroys...
Well, not necessarily. I mean, if rain came in and fell onto the data and destroyed it, that certainly wasn't anybody's doing. It was just, an accident where it was stored. So does it make any difference if there's bad faith or if it was unintentional?
Well, I think this whole case has to be viewed against the whole public policy of transparency. Why can this city get away with destroying stuff when it's not keeping evidence in accordance with state guidelines? That to me is bad faith. It's a deliberate decision. And moreover, we were never given any policy, written policy about how documents were supposed to be stored. It's always all the main defense appears to be, this is the way we've always done it. And in preparing this argument, I thought, how about if Derek Chauvin uses that argument? Oh, this is the way we've always done it. How far do you think he'd get with that? He would not get very far. So this is a very important public policy issue that this court has to take seriously. I'm not saying that it isn't, but it's one that applies to the whole state of Minnesota. And I don't think the appellate court of this state would want to go on record as saying it's okay for a governmental entity in this state just to destroy documents whenever they want to. I don't think that's appropriate. But I think I need to move on to, I see I've only got 2.5 minutes, the reasonably neat and clean argument. Reasonably clean and neat is a very ill-defined term. Neat and clean are not defined in the ordinance. It allows a arbitrary and potentially discriminatory way to enforce this statute. I think just about everybody could agree, has their own idea of what clean and neat makes, what clean and make, clean and neat is. And do we want to have a criminal statute with those words? It just leaves it open for any kind of arbitrary and discriminatory behavior on the part of the government. And that's what we have here. The ordinance itself only talks about things that shall be included in that definition, but they're all a whole host of things that aren't included that are subject to the interpretation of the government official. Any government official can find someone in violation of the ordinance just by saying, hey, your backyard's not neat and clean, not reasonably neat and clean. This ordinance is void for vagueness because of the terms that are not defined.
How would you fashion such an ordinance then that requires property to be kept up? I mean, other than having this laundry list of what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, I mean, how would you suggest that it should have been framed so that it would be appropriate?
Well, I can say what I think, but I'm not a government official. I don't have the authority to develop a criminal statute that can result in people going to jail for up to 90 days. That's for the government to decide. I think
these terms are— Isn't that part of the reason that the written notice requirements to your client in particular, I think there was two written notices to find explicitly what it was that he was in violation of?
Yes, Your Honor, in really thinking about this, I don't think these two terms can be adequately defined in a criminal statute. There has to be some other way they can come up with it. Maybe they should.
We've got a problem with that because in the criminal world we have the reasonable person, and that has been subject to test.
I know, and I agree with the court, but it's just, this is the kind of statute, particularly in a city like Rochester, where we have 15% non-white population, that presents an opportunity for the government to be arbitrary and discriminatory. I see my time is up.
Thank you. You'll have your rebuttal time. Mr. Carlson.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Brent Carlson, Deputy Rochester City Attorney, on behalf of the respondent in this case. I'll argue in the same order as Mr. French did, starting with the issue in regards to the metadata. Just by way of background from the court, Mr. Robinson lives in sort of the Kutski Park neighborhood, sort of in a downtown area. Typical size city lot, two-story house, older two-story house. A complaint came to the attention of Rochester Building Safety in December of 2017. An inspector went out to the property, inspected, and noticed that the property was consistent with the complaint. Some time passed, and in September of 2018, so approximately 9 months later, another inspection was done by Susan Laguerre Golden with Building Safety and found the property to be in substantially similar condition. That was on September 24th, 2018. She took some pictures at that time. The pictures included, as she testified, from both the public sidewalk.
I'm sorry I'm interrupting you. What was her position?
She is the manager of Building Safety, of Rochester Building Safety. And basically she indicated that she had taken some photographs from the public sidewalk, and she had also taken some photographs from the street. There was also some photographs that were taken of the front step, as that's what sort of contributed to count two in this case.
From the front step, not just of the front step, but from it. Mm-hmm.
Right, actually from the front step. And it was, I was also trial counsel, so I was involved with the trial as well. And it was clear that those photographs were taken actually on the front step. And so we had a contested omnibus hearing on that issue, and basically the judge suppressed only the photographs of the front step specifically, but allowed the state to continue with the photographs of the home otherwise. And one of the questions I think one of your honors raised earlier during Mr. French's argument is, what's your argument as to whether or not these were on the front sidewalk? And I can tell the court that at least a couple of the photographs, you can actually see the public sidewalk. So it's a typical, maybe a 20-foot front yard, a sidewalk, and then a 5 or 6 foot boulevard out into the public street. And you could actually see that grassy area and then the sidewalk. So no question that those particular photographs were taken in a public place. Basically what happened is another inspection was done in October of 2018. And at that time, nothing had changed, so that the charges were referred to my office for charging. I would note that a warning notice was sent to Mr. Robinson in December of 2017. A notice of violation was sent to Mr. Robinson in September of 2018. And then it was a whole nother year until August of 2019, until we had that trial, and still nothing had been cleaned up. So in this particular case, we're dealing with those photographs that Mr. French argues, or appellant argues, were taken potentially from his property. What he doesn't argue is a discovery violation in regards to the state not providing discovery. That's not something that was argued. In fact, the state exchanged discovery at least twice. Mr. Robinson was pro se at the beginning, so all of the discovery materials were handed over to Mr. Robinson as a pro se litigant. And then again, when he retained counsel in April of 2019, again, discovery was shared with his defense counsel throughout that again. So in this case, the defendant has to show bad faith, and this court must consider whether or not the evidence was apparent and material at the time it was destroyed. I think both parties agree that we don't have the digital images. We have paper copies of all the images, but we do not have digital versions.
Before when counsel, I want to hear the rest of that, just for one framing question, just with respect to the issue, because now we're moving into the substantive, the standard under the destruction of evidence. If the district court, or if, let's say, if we were to find that the reverse the district court, that it was destroyed, you know, in violation of constitutional rights, and the purpose or the value of that evidence was to support a suppression motion, should we be reversing? In other words, the fact that the evidence was useful for a Fourth Amendment violation as opposed to innocence, exculpating him, does that matter? I mean, would he still be entitled to reversal?
Let me just try to think through your question here a second.
So, I mean, if we found it to have been destroyed for whatever reason, let's just posit. I'm just trying to understand what the scope, if there's been anything forfeited here. If in fact it was destroyed in bad faith and it was material to a Fourth Amendment suppression issue, would that be grounds for reversal? Or has there been any sort of forfeiture of the Fourth Amendment issue?
I don't think so. What I'm telling this court is I believe that these photographs were taken from a public place. I think that the photographs are clear. They show specifically that the scaffolding. There was also some testimony from Ms. Laguerre Golden that she had received permission from the neighbor in order to enter the neighbor's property to get a little closer look into the backyard. This is a property where there's sort of a fence on the back side, and then sort of halfway up the front side where the driveway goes in. So she had indicated that some of the photos of the backyard in particular were taken actually from the neighbor's property who she had received permission from. Metadata that appellant requests, I think, is sort of speculative at best. We don't necessarily know. We can argue that it's going to contain GPS data, but is it going to contain GPS data that's a bit specific enough? We're talking perhaps a matter of feet here.
These arguments then go to the question of whether there was either, I guess, exculpatory value or at least some defense value. May not have been exculpatory, but it might have been supporting of a suppression motion, that it wasn't evident and material that the metadata would play that role. Is that right?
I think certainly, you know, having the GPS coordinates, there's probably an expert out there that could probably tell, you know, go out there and stand where the GPS coordinates are and maybe draw a map or something like that. I don't necessarily dispute that. I think the question here that this court needs to determine is, was the value of this known at the time they were deleted? Keeping in mind that we're not talking about the photographs. I think Ms. Laguerre Golden's goal here was to preserve the photos.
May I ask you, counsel, did the district court make a finding about bad faith?
The district court did not. And I don't think bad faith was even actually raised at the time.
Okay, what's the test? Is that necessary, bad faith, or not? I mean, does good faith excuse it, in other words, the destruction?
I'm not sure that good faith necessarily excuses it, but the bad faith requirement, I cited it in my brief. I can't exactly.
Mr. Carlson? you've indicated there was no finding of bad faith, but in this case, the judge did find that it was an honest, reasonable mistake of fact. Isn't that your recall of the record? I mean, if you don't necessarily have to say there was no bad faith, if you're saying that the result of the photos or even being on Robinson's property was the result of an honest, reasonable mistake of fact.
Right. We did. I don't think there was a discussion about unreasonable mistake of fact in regards to the photos that were taken from the front, just because they were pretty evident as to where they were taken. I think the unreasonable mistake of fact was in regards to her taking the photographs near the fence. Basically, what had happened is Mr. Robinson, after this all happened, he had went out and he got an official survey of his property. And the surveyor testified that the property, you know, I think Ms. Laguerre-Golden was assuming that the fence was on the property line. But when we got the survey back, the surveyor actually said that the property line was a foot or two on the other side of the fence. So presumably, if Ms. Laguerre-Golden was at the fence, she technically would have been on Mr. Robinson's property. But at that time, you know, we didn't have a survey. There wasn't any evident stakes or anything, or obviously no lines or anything indicating the property line. So I think that's where maybe the mistake of fact sort of plays into this case. Ms. Laguerre-Golden had been with Rochester Building Safety since 1991. So it's not like we had a rookie out there taking these types of photographs. We've got, you know, the manager of building safety, someone that's been doing this for quite some time. So I'd argue to this court that, first of all, this was not bad faith when Ms. Laguerre-Golden at some point deleted these photos from her phone. She figured that she had sufficiently preserved them by uploading them into her computer. And then ultimately, you know, we ultimately received them as part of our discovery and disclosed them timely to the defense.
I wonder if you could shift to the other argument that the appellant's raising. So do you think reasonably clean and neat is reasonable?
So I would note for the court that the Hard Times Cafe case, it's a 2001 Minnesota Court of Appeals case, basically says that a municipal ordinance is presumed to be constitutional. So there's a presumption that this ordinance is constitutional, and that a statute is void for vagueness if it defines an act that encourages arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement, or it's so indefinite that the people must get at its meeting. Now, the appellant would have this court read the reasonably neat and clean condition in a vacuum. But the statute or the ordinance is much more than that. It goes on to specifically define or lists examples of things that aren't considered to be neat and clean, such as dead trees, unusable equipment, unused building materials. And I won't read the entire ordinance for the court, as I'm sure it's been included in both my addendum as well as appellant's addendum. But I think the court needs to read this ordinance in its totality. And as this court well knows, when specific words aren't defined by the drafters, we look to their plain and ordinary meaning. So literally, I got out a dictionary when I was writing my brief, and I sort of researched what neat and clean mean. And I believe as it was Judge Smith indicated earlier, perhaps it was Judge Werke, in regards to the reasonable standard. Obviously, we have proof beyond a reasonable doubt, a standard that we prosecutors deal with all the time in criminal law. And it's that of an ordinary, prudent person, someone of, prudent and ordinary person. I guess I'll keep it at that. Let's see. I would also note for that this court that the language in the warning notice.
So you sort of take your analogy forward, you know, in the definition of reasonable doubt, you know, it's a doubt based on reason and common sense. And what you're asking us is we should all apply common sense when we look at something that says reasonably clean and neat. Go ahead. So I assume that you would agree. You know, we should apply
common sense.
What was unreasonably clean well, I don't know, I guess, what was unreasonably clean and dirty and messy about the stuff on his property? Was it the scaffolding? You know, so give me,
Yep. So so it was sort of a mix of things. The scaffolding, there was testimony that the gutters are 16 feet tall. So we're, and the scaffolding was higher than the gutters on the house. So we're talking about large scaffolding, sort of type of scaffolding that you would use to shingle a roof or something of that nature, side a house. And there was testimony by appellant's own admission that this scaffolding had been up for since about 2014, sometime in 2014. So it's not like it had been put up, and he was intending to shingle the house or side the house or something like that. It had been up for nearly 6 years at this point, and it remains up today. Also, there was some testimony in regards to the condition of the backyard. There was a gas stove that typically, it's not like we're talking about a gas grill. We're talking about an actual like old style gas stove that you would find in like an old farmhouse type place that was covered in a tarp and actually hooked up to the gas, sitting outside. There were unused building materials sort of scattered around in little piles. There was concrete, there were bricks. So there were various items that had clearly not been used in an extended period of time by virtue of the weeds growing around them and things of that nature. I do see that my time is running short, so barring any additional questions by the court, I'm asking that this court deny the motion and uphold the conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Back to you, Mr. French.
Thank you, Judge. Judge Smith raised a very interesting question, which is, okay, but what would the, how would the photographs have, the question is this just strictly a suppression issue or is it a due process issue? And, you know, maybe I'm not articulating that question accurately, but the thing is here that the destruction of evidence, if that argument had been accepted by the trial court, there would have been no photographs at the trial. Every single photograph would have been precluded, and therefore the court would have to make a decision based on the oral testimony of the two parties. And that, of course, would have been a much more difficult undertaking for the government. And I wonder, just looking at this from a practical standpoint, there's no written policy in this department, and they have a way of doing things. It's sort of like, in my opinion, is almost Neolithic in a way, because they transfer the digital photos to a computer in the office. Why remove them? It would be much easier to, when there's a case, to just simply send to the opposing lawyer or to the defendant digital copies of the photos would be much simpler. What they're seeking to do here is have this court sanction a system that might have been doable 30 or 40 years ago, but it's simply not appropriate now, particularly given the deadlines or the guidelines that have been set by the state of Minnesota. This deals.
May I ask a couple questions? First of all, though, when we get into the question of the destruction of property of evidence, which is, I think, a due process issue, which is what I think you're arguing, it's a court needs to consider whether it was intentional and whether the exculpatory value was apparent and material. I mean, we've focused, I think, on both of those in a way, but I think with respect to intentional, and we've talked about good faith, bad faith, that's why I was just wondering what the party's positions were around that. I mean, clearly they were intentionally deleted. They didn't happen as a result of a power surge or something. But the question is, I think whether they were intended to deprive the defendant of evidence. And I don't know if the district court made any specific findings around that, but it seemed like it was consistent with, you take them off your phone, you don't keep them on the phone because it takes up, that seemed to be their consistent practice, not to deprive defendants of evidence, but just because once they switch them to the computer in order to print them, they don't need them on their phone anymore.
Who decides whether something was destroyed to deprive the defendant of possible exculpatory evidence?
Or, I think a district court.
Well, how do you determine that in this case? And I think—
But isn't that where the district court would make findings that there was, I mean, when a district court makes findings that that the photos being on Robinson's property, even if she was a result of an honest, reasonable mistake of fact, doesn't that undo what you're arguing?
No, because the rules, and I don't know if this is enforceable by litigation, but the state of Minnesota establishes guidelines for the to maintain documents for every government undertaking in the state. Why does Rochester get an exception? Why are they allowed to—
Apropos of Judge Werke's question, with respect to the stuff that was on his lawn, you could get the GPS data and prove exactly that they were on his lawn, but if the district court already concluded it doesn't matter because being there was a mistake of fact, it doesn't make the metadata particularly valuable anymore because it's already a mistake of fact.
But Your Honor, it relates to how the case would have been tried. This case being tried without photographs is a different case. And the defendant has a much better chance of prevailing in that situation. I also wanted to say that on the void for vagueness argument, the statute—
Well, wait a minute, Mr. French, what do you mean by the defendant would have had a much better chance of prevailing? Because we have testimony and they both stand in the same shoes until a credibility decision is made. But we also have the letters that were sent. So tell me in what measure you mean he would have been in a better place?
Well, the summons only stated, wood, plastic, and miscellaneous items. It really wasn't defined. It left it up to the government to decide how they were going to present this case. And if without the photographs, they would have had to testify. And that the general issue of whether this neat and clean is too void and vague to be in a criminal statute or criminal ordinance. That's the issue here. And I think it is. This case should, the conviction should be vacated and of course, costs and disbursements awarded to the appellant.
Thank you. Mr. French, as well as you, Mr. Carlson. We appreciate you appearing by WebEx in support of your written documents. The matters are deemed submitted and a decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe.
Thank you, Joe.